Hello, and thank you for listening to the new series, Series 2 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This series aims to chat to clinical academics and to really identify what their role entails, how their jobs are split, what they do in their daily life, and really what are the tips and what advice can they give to people aspiring to be a clinical academic. So give us a listen, share the podcast with others, press follow wherever you listen to or get your podcasts, and we hope you enjoy the episodes. Hello, and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And today I am delighted to have with me the Vice Chancellor of the University of Wollongong in Australia. And I do so on this bonus episode because she's also a nurse and a nurse researcher. So we're honoured to have you on the show, Trish. It's delighted to have you with us.
It's my honour to be here. Thank you so much, Andrew, for the opportunity.
And I do have to tell the listener again, I say this, I try not to date stamp the episode, so I don't sort of say when it is and what time of year it is. But having recently visited you in Australia, again, wonderful campus, wonderful university, and a credit to you and the Department of Nursing or the School of Nursing, you know, so welcoming and such positive and professional staff. It was great to be there.
Right. Oh, it was wonderful to have you. Look forward to having you back.
Yes, I hope so. Fingers crossed, I'll always say. But this is all about you. So I think, you know, for the listener to hear a vice chancellor of a university and a nurse, we wouldn't usually associate the two. So we have to go right the way back for you, because we always want to, because I worry that people think you just dropped into these roles and, you know, you were born for it. But actually, you're a nurse and you started as a nurse like everybody else. So tell us how you became a nurse and why.
Well, Andrew, that's a really interesting question. And so I never grew up wanting to be a nurse because I didn't really kind of know what nurses did. Also, I'm for the listeners, you know, it's good. I'm not on camera, but I'm 67 years of age. So, you know, I've seen a lot of transitions in nursing. When I was at school, and, you know, it took me a while to, and probably even now, I just kind of think it's hard to admit that you're smart and you're good. But, you know, at school, I was probably smart and good. And so I was pretty much channeled into, you know, subjects and really thinking really that I was going to do political science, law, nursing was really never presented to me as an option. And really it was the devastation of my mother dying when I was in my final year of high school. She died in the beginning of the year in the February. And I remember at the time, and of course, as time progresses, you process these thoughts and views. But I remember at the time actually being jealous of the nurses because they could give my mother comfort and relieve her suffering. And also, you know, as you can imagine, I also felt that my mother was pushing me away in some ways, I think trying to, you know, like protect her children. So, you know, so I finished high school, went to university, and you dropped out. So it's, you can be a university dropout and still a vice chancellor. And I dropped out because basically, you know, I was likely depressed, anguished. Our family was in turmoil. And just one day I stopped going to university. And I sometimes joke to that vice chancellor, maybe they're still looking for me because I just stopped going. And very different to universities of this time where we have follow-up and, you know, I just stopped going. And then I started waitressing. It was pretty clear that that was not going to be my life's work. And then one of my colleagues I was waitressing with was going nursing. And, you know, it's funny, I just thought, well, maybe I'll try nursing. So I actually moved to Wollongong. I grew up in Canberra and I moved to Wollongong in a relationship at the time and actually trained to be a nurse in a hospital diploma program at Wollongong Hospital. And from the very first day I started, I loved it. And till this day, I still love nursing. I still love my ability to influence patient care. I still love my ability to connect. And even in your own leadership roles, and you probably know as well, Andrew, you know how you can identify suffering in your colleagues and students and how you can intervene. So it's a very long and convoluted story as to, you know, why and how I became a nurse and why I'm really passionate about increasing the profile of nursing, because nursing, I often say, is a fabulous profession and a wonderful career. And we often talk about nurses as being kind and caring, but we don't often talk about nurses being smart. And as we know, the very best nurses are smart and kind.
And I mean, I go back. I mean, it's a sad story, isn't it, to lose your mum to, and almost get that sort of that pull into nursing for perhaps reasons that you never wished for in the first place. But for you, did that sort of did that delay moving in you into academia? Was it the patient bedside? Was it the sort of being close to the patient that was most
Well,
important for you?
yeah, look, I think I have really had the great advantage of being a clinician researcher, nurse researcher. So I've never been far from the bedside. Even in my previous role at Johns Hopkins as the dean of the School of Nursing there, one of the great things that we used to do at Hopkins is that the chief nursing officer and myself and the Dean of Medicine would do rounds in the hospital. I was a sponsor, executive sponsor of a patient safety committee. And also, you know, I've been really embedded in clinical research. So I think for nurse researchers, if you do develop effective interventions, or if you do challenge the status quo, or if you do push boundaries forward, as a nurse researcher, you're just not influencing the care of a single patient. You have the potential to influence the care of thousands of patients. So I think I've never been far away from being a clinician.
Absolutely. And that will lead us into this episode really on the series, because it's the clinical academic series, which is still a relatively new title in the UK, and a title that we've probably just started to apply to people that have a dual role across academia and healthcare. But how did you make the leap? So you talked about a diploma. You talked about being smart. So, at what point did somebody recognize you to push you on academically, or did you drive for that yourself?
Well, no. Well, look, it's really interesting. So I was in this diploma program and I probably, you know, felt I could do a little bit more. Also, as you can imagine, there was a huge paradox of society at that time. You know, I was at the Australian National University in sort of the end of the Vietnam War with a very proactive student, socially active society. And then when I moved into being a nursing student, it was like it was really kind of very paradoxical. I can remember vividly someone crossing my name off, Patricia, and putting SN, student nurse. So I went into an environment of universe, you know, uniforms, brown hall shoes, and, you know, really quite constrained. And then I thought, look, I could go to university part-time. So when I was still doing my nursing program, and of course, you know, it's not unbelievable this would happen, because I'm sure many of the listeners to this program are juggling family, work, and study. And I just at that stage had to juggle myself. So I went back with one of my really good colleagues, John Daly, and we went to university together. And it was really when I was at university, you know, I started and really took subjects such as, you know, psychology, sociology, political science. And I think then that really crystallized my views of what social determinants of health. Well, like I didn't have those words at that time, but I really thought there is much more than this very narrow biomedical model. And look, you can imagine in the late 70s, it was very narrow biomedical hierarchical model. John Daly and I often joke, you know, we had to scrub the surgeon's boots when we were in nursing school. You know, that's how hierarchical it was. So I went to university. You know, I did a BA and an MED. Like many nurses, I've had the great privilege of being a mother. And I actually was a foundation professor at the University of Wollongong. And actually, as a student representative, as part of that school of nursing being developed. But, you know, one of the great things about nursing is, you know, I always taught a little bit part time, but in very different times, I had the great privilege of being able to be a mum and also being able to work. And that was great. But if what was the real catalyst in my career was when I feel like I emerged from night shift and weekends, and you know, when my kids were little, and I'd had a job as a research nurse in heart failure. And I worked with a wonderful cardiologist, Warren Walsh. And he was very English and very stern. And he called me into his office one day and looked over his glasses and he said, "You need to go to the American Heart Association meeting." And, you know, I was stunned because, firstly, I thought I was in trouble because that was the sort of nursing I grew up in, of always being afraid of doing something wrong and, you know, crazy people that. Could you imagine one of the charge nurses used to hide the laryngoscope of the crash cart just to check that you'd done it? So I'd grown up in a very fearful environment. So he said, "You have to go to the American Heart Association meeting." So I'll never forget that because, you know, and it really gave me some important lessons. I know many people, many of my nursing colleagues have believed in me and saw potential, but here was someone who saw potential but had the money to invest in me. So he sent me to the American Heart Association meeting in Atlanta. I'd never been to the US, first time away from my, you know, children. And I sat in a section and, you know, cardiology was my field, and I was really enthralled by one of the speakers. And I think there was something about her talk. Because it was about acute coronary syndrome, I remember that, but it was her emphasis on patients and caregivers that was qualitatively different. Because in those days in Australia, the Cardiac Society, the nurses presented on the Sunday before the May meeting, and this was in the May meeting. And I looked down and I saw, oh, she's a nurse. So that was Dean Kathy Drakeup, who, you know, is just. I think people have written an article about her in Journal of Cardiovascular Nursing, Mentor Extraordinaire. And it was just very serendipitous. So a very long time ago, I remember I faxed her. You know, this is pre-email. And I said, "You know, I so enjoyed your talk." And she was coming to Australia on a Fulbright. And I remember taking her to dinner. And, you know, I'd always thought, oh, look, here she is. She's tall and blonde and elegant. And, you know, how could I do this? You know, I've got young children, et cetera. And then over dinner, she told me she had five children. And I thought, well, look, just get on with it and go. But up until this day, she's been an amazing mentor to me. And it was at that time I started doing my PhD, which I did in the Faculty of Behavioral Sciences in medicine. That's another story, but she was really my nurse mentor along the way. So I've been really fortunate to have just not just wonderful colleagues, but people who have supported and mentored me.
And your PhD was around heart failure. That was around the area of
Yes, it was
field of work you were.
just called Living with Heart Failure. And I was really fortunate to do a randomized controlled trial of heart failure rehabilitation, because back in those days, for younger listeners, you know, in when I started nursing, beta blockers were contraindicated because of the negative inotropic effects. But we now know that you're really investigating and addressing neurohormonal activation has made such a difference in heart failure. And also, exercise was contraindicated. So, as I started to set up this heart failure rehabilitation program, that was, I think has now in our country been a pretty standard model because it adopted a cardiac rehabilitation model. I had a wonderful PhD supervisor, Jill Coburn, which was kind of eerie because she died in the last year of my PhD, which was actually, incredibly sad. But I just had such good training. And at that time, really, PhDs were very nascent in Australia. And I feel that I was really fortunate to be able to get very good methodological training, get NHMRC funding, and really set me off on a track to for being an independent investigator.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people talk about serendipity, but I keep arguing back to nurses. Say, well, you have to be the right person to be in the right place at the right time, don't you? So I think you have to credit yourself for these things. People recognize talent. They recognize the gift that you have for these things. So I always argue back with nurses that I don't know that it's always serendipity. I think it's because of you, isn't it, that you get where you get to.
Well, I think being open to opportunities, look, that's what I would always tell, colleagues, more junior colleagues, seek supportive and enabling environments and be open to opportunities. I think that's what's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that sort of, so you were postdoc, you were still clinical. What was the time it took? What time did it take you to get to professorship? How did you achieve the chair? What was the sort of build up to that? Was that somebody else again? Was somebody encouraging you to do that? Or was that your driver to want to be professor?
No, look, I think again, for many nurses, understanding the academic world is a bit tricky. As I mentioned, my good friend John Daly, he'd kind of been a dean and he'd offered me an adjunct appointment. So I got to know, understand academia a little bit. And my first professor, my first appointment was as an associate professor. And it was a joint clinical chair between a local health district and the Western Sydney University. And it was there that, I really, got to understand the academy. I really had to sort of broker the nuances of these joint roles, which, everyone thinks they're great. I think they're conceptually alluring, but very challenging. If I had to be honest, at that time, I felt I was not keeping everybody happy because I really don't think that the Area Health Service or the nursing leadership understood what research was. I felt I was keeping the university happy. But then the other thing is to be a successful investigator, to be a rainmaker investigator. Now, many nurses can do research and be part of a team. But if you're the person bringing in the money, you've got to be very focused. And I just felt in that role, I was spending a whole lot of time doing things that weren't advancing the science or my career. So I was very fortunate, again, by another fabulous nurse, Linda Christensen, who was at that stage vice president research at Curtin. I then got a chair in cardiovascular nursing that was between St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney and Curtin University. So, what was different about that role is that it was very much a narrow cardiovascular research role, whereas the other previous thing was, go create research, create improve outcomes. But some of those roles are really very, very challenging and getting the expectations right. And so again, then being at St. Vincent's, having a wonderful clinical team on the both the medical and nursing side, in a focused area allowed me to kind of keep moving forward.
And you were again, and I've spoken to a few people, certainly in our professor series, series one, who were probably clinical academics before we had the title clinical academic. And it remains a challenge, particularly in the UK, where we're driving for people to have that dual role, that we don't want to take people straight into academia now and lose the nursing aspect of their role and, become educators. We want people, if they certainly if they want a research component to their career, we want them to have a clinical component of what as well. What tips would you have, or what would you recommend to people trying to do that dual role? Because I call it a dual role, but actually they should bleed into one another. And the research should help the clinical role, and the clinical role should help the academia. But it's hard to get that right. What tips would you give to people that were trying to merge the two?
Well, I think firstly, you have to be in an environment that's going to support research beyond tokenism. And to do good research, you need to have environments that support that. So I think that's the number one reason. Be realistic about expectations. I really agree, Andrew, that you have to. I often have this diagram of four circles. Policy, practice, education, and research. And if the patient and their family at the center, how do each of the bits of what you do all contribute to that? So I think you're absolutely right. It's about focus, it's about the environment, it's about having good colleagues, and it's about really being focused and keeping your eye on the prize. Often in particularly in nursing, pardon me, we have a culture where we don't want anyone to stand out. And, we feel like, everyone wants to be the same, and we don't want, Australia the tall poppy. But I think we need to really support a culture that understands research. Understands that you need a rainmaker, someone who's going to bring in the money, and you need someone who's going to lead the team. So I think as our profession develops and evolves, particularly in clinician researchers, we actually have to think about who is the lead investigator, who is the person who is going to be supporting, nurturing, enabling the team. And I think that's another important aspect as you people become a nurse researcher. And I have had so many magnificent colleagues in my career. Not everybody has to be the captain of the team. And it's interesting, I learned a lot about leadership being the manager of my daughter's basketball team. Firstly, it took me a while to think, why do all the coaches want me to be the manager? And then I thought, oh, then I worked it out. Don't be seduced by flattery. Number one, I was a nurse, so I was always good for those sprains and scrapes. Number two, I really genuinely liked the kids. I could cook anything out of an electric frying pan in a cheap motel. But probably my greatest attribute was that I didn't want to be the coach, and I was being happy being the manager. So learning from those great young women on that team, I realized that you could change the direction of a game by just the support of the team. That the person who is the star is not successful without the team. So I think making people feel comfortable in the team and valuing expertise is really important. And being a team member as a nurse researcher is also really important. And I don't think we think about that enough in nursing, because now we're in the era of big team science. And it's not about you being the first author or the first name investigator. I think it's really about shifting to what is the impact of our work. And I still think in nursing, we can do pretty amazing work without a whole lot of money. And sometimes I think we spend a lot of money, time chasing money that is elusive, but we can actually do a lot of really good work.
I completely agree. Now, from your perspective, if you had your, and I always drop this question onto people, but if you were able to start your nurse researcher career again, would you do anything differently?
Oh, yes, I would. I would publish in high impact journals. I remember, I think in my early in my career, I would think, no, I'm a clinician. I really want to influence clinical care. Maybe I did. So I would publish in clinical journals. So that's number one. The other thing is, I have very few regrets. I really think why I've probably been more successful is that I've been able to take risks and move. I'm not, when it, you've probably the same, Andrew. I hate sitting in interview committees and say, oh, they've moved around a lot. That's not a bad thing, that's my personal view. And the other thing that if I could have changed anything, it would have been able to do my PhD full time and to do a real postdoc. But, by that stage of life, Martha Hill, who was previous dean to me at Johns Hopkins, she said, yeah, you were a geriatric PhD. I don't think I was that old, but I was definitely, well into my 40s. So, so that's why I really encourage young nurses to just keep going. There's a great article in Australian Higher Education. It's called, It's Not a Nobel Prize, It's Just a PhD. So I think really encouraging nurses who are interested in research to move quickly from their clinical training to through to research training. And then they've got such a long runway to contribute. I think it is such, it pains me when people say you haven't had enough clinical experience and all of those things. We wouldn't say that in any other career to a molecular chemist. I'll go and, pipette test tubes for 5 years and then come back and do your PhD. And I think it's really about celebrating the whole of our profession, the importance of clinical care, the importance of research, and also the importance of, our culture and advocacy and contributions to community.
I completely agree, and I think we've probably woken up to that in the UK over the last decade, particularly that aspect of, you haven't got to go and tread the boards as such for 5 or 10 years and then come back. Not particularly, I mean, for education it's slightly different because you educate from your experience and from your anecdotes with a lot of, with a lot of the time. But with research, if you're the high flyer, if you're the trailblazer in your cohort, then you should continue, shouldn't you, and carry on. And if that's what you want to do, then do it, push into the academic side of the role.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And Trish, my final question for you is your career highlights. If somebody said to you, right, what's your career highlight? What are you most proud of? What would you say?
Look, I think I'm really proud of being able to advance palliative care and heart failure. I think I've really pushed a lot in that respect and really challenged traditional paradigms, had amazing support from my particular cardiology colleagues, Peter MacDonald and Chris Haywood. So that's one thing, like clinically, really being able to advance the science of heart failure. I think my other great achievement is my amazing mentees, and I often think the lessons you learn in life are from your students and your patients. And also, I was really incredibly proud of at Johns Hopkins to be able to, with my colleagues there, to foster some new degrees that are taking nursing to a different level, particularly the combination of the Doctor of Nursing Practice, PhD, so, really trying to push the clinician scientists, Doctor of Nursing Practice, MBA, so how do we really get nurses to be, able to sit shoulder to shoulder with the CFOs, the MBA. And then the other one was the Doctor of Nursing Practice, Masters of Public Health. So I think I'm really, really fortunate that I've had a long and very rewarding career. But still, I will never forget also the patients who really motivated and inspired me to really move forward and take, particularly improving the way people die with heart failure. And like all every nurse, we all have those faces about those patients who motivate and inspire us and prompt us into action.
Yeah, absolutely. And clearly such a wonderful career and a career that you've carved out at a time when it was probably more difficult for nurses to do what you did than it is now, because we see the opportunity and we recognize nursing as a profession. So all credit to you that you've done it over that time period and really had to be the trailblazer for the people that have followed behind you. So it's a wonderful story. Can I email you and ask you for some of your papers and some of the things that we can put in the notes of the podcast?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It would be
And
lovely to see some of your work on there as well.
yeah. And it's also interesting to look back on your career and just see how you evolve as a scholar, how you evolve as a scientist. But to me, for why nurses make such good researchers is that we're good as team members. And that's what science of the future is all about, the interdisciplinary team. And the other thing is, I think you're absolutely right, Andrew. Growing up as a nurse, growing up in cardiology as a woman, you learn how to manage people, you learn how to manage teams, you know how to negotiate. And I think that's probably what a really critical skill, how to negotiate, how to get the best deal for your patients and your families. And in essence, that's how you write a good grant. A good grant is all about negotiation. How are you convincing people? Why should you give me the money? It's about the art of negotiation.
Fantastic. Thank you. A wonderful final tip, and we'll definitely make sure that we've got some of your work on there to share with the listener and make sure that they can look back on some of the highlights of your career through some of your publications. I think that would be perfect. So, Patricia Davidson, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Andrew. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And to the listeners, just believe in yourself. Remember, nurses are smart and kind. And if you keep the patient and their family the focus of what you do, it doesn't seem like work. It really seems like the essence of nursing. And that's what we are meant to do.
Perfect. Trish, thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Nurse Researcher podcast. And again, I'm joined by Eleanor, and today we're discussing the episode you've just listened to. So, Patricia Davidson, a vice chancellor of a university, a nurse researcher, quite the role model, Eleanor. What was your take on that? What did you think?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. So it was really interesting listening to Patricia's interview. And like you say, I think she gave quite a different view from a different context in Australia, especially as a vice chancellor of a university. I'm not familiar particularly with how the clinical academic pathway looks or works over in Australia, but I thought there were some really positive sentiments that I took from Patricia's interview. If you are developing a research career, one of those was about being open to opportunities, You know, she mentioned seeking supportive and enabling environments. And I thought it was interesting that she had support not just from nursing colleagues. Initially, she mentioned the cardiologist who advised her to go to the American Heart Association. But at first she thought, if I recall correctly, she thought she might have been in trouble at first and then realized he was actually trying to help her. So that was, I think that's a really important point. And, you know, also to realize actually you don't just need nursing colleagues to support you here either. You know, it's a multidisciplinary team can sometimes be really beneficial, can't it, if you're developing research. And then the other one she mentioned was about letting your clinical experience and your patients that you care for inspire you to develop research ideas. And then something else that I don't think has come up previously was around where talking about your career and how sometimes you can end up doing lots of things, but not necessarily advancing your career. So I suppose it's a case of choosing wisely what you decide you want to invest your energy in. And of course, being involved in wider activities is really good and can be really rewarding, can't it? But I think it's about getting that balance right. And then she also touched on, you know, joint roles. So if you hold a clinical and an academic post, these can be challenging roles. And sometimes there is that lack of understanding about research in general and more specifically how clinical academic roles work. So that's obviously a similarity between the two countries, but it can make it more challenging, can't it? Because it means people don't always understand what the role is supposed to look like. And partly that's because they're quite bespoke. So, you know, it's different for everybody. But those points she did raise, I thought that sounds quite similar to here. And then she also opened up, or maybe she wasn't opening up the debate, but for me, it was a debate I've heard before around at what point should you embark on a clinical academic or academic career, referring to herself as a geriatric PhD student. And I mean, I'm probably one of those too. So I often think I should have started much sooner, but I think there are a number of factors that influence that decision. And sometimes life dictates, doesn't it? As well as opportunities or lack of opportunities. So there's the argument that you need clinical experience, isn't there? I've heard that, you know, to inform your research. But my view is very much that it's a personal and practical decision, I think.
Yeah. And
so
I
really
think,
interesting.
Mm. Yeah. And I think, well, firstly, you're not geriatric. so just let the listener know. But I think, you know, the right time to do a PhD is when it's the right time for you, when everything comes together, you know, the environment, the supervisory team, the question, your candidacy, whatever it might be, it's putting all the pieces of the jigsaw together.
Yeah.
Now, if that just so happened straight after your training, then great. She went,
yeah,
she went,
exactly.
She recognized that, didn't she? She said, we wouldn't put people out. We shouldn't be saying to people, you've got to go and do 5 years clinical experience when actually you'd be ready to go. But nurses are ready to go at different times.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think your academic ability builds up through the layers and layers that you do of continual learning, you know, and the lifelong learning that we do. So you have to feel ready to do it. And if you're 23 or you're 43, it makes no difference. I don't think as long as, you know, you've got that, the you're going to bring some value at the end of it. If you're going to do a PhD, don't do it to retire. And certainly when I started as an academic 20 years ago, there were lots of people that almost finished on a PhD, and it was a bit sort of like, you know, that was the cherry on the cake and that's, you know, mission complete. And that didn't make any sense to me back then, and it doesn't now. So the fact that we've got people that establish PhDs, good careers, good postdoctoral careers, it's irrespective of their age, I think that's what we should be looking at.
Yeah. And generally you're looking, you know, at developing your research where it can develop into a program of research, aren't you? You know, years and years of research in a particular area that will lead on from one thing to the next. So when you finish your PhD, hopefully that will lead on to your postdoctoral research, et cetera. And it goes on, doesn't it? It's usually kind of a lifetime endeavor, or maybe not a lifetime, but a good chunk.
And I think with Trish's episode, and she did say I could call her Trish. I felt very informal calling her Trish as the vice chancellor, and it's on record as well that she did say you must come back to Wollongong University. So I just want that noted again that she did say you must come back. I'll use that for my employers perhaps. But I liked it when she said that as a nurse researcher, she felt like she could influence thousands of patients rather than, you know, a few. And she sort of talked about. Really, I mean, she'd trodden the boards, hadn't she? Because she'd started nursing at a time where it was very hierarchical, and she'd identified that. She talked about scrubbing the surgeon's boots.
Yeah.
probably with somebody like her who's very senior now.
Yeah.
And so I always talk about whether people think almost people were born to be professors of nursing, and they're not. They all start at this, where we all started. They all start at the very beginning, in that first part of the career. So talking about scrubbing surgeons' boots, and that's coming from, the mouth of a vice chancellor of a university, is it's good to hear, isn't it? We don't want those apprenticeship styles now like that. It sounded like some sort of football YTS, didn't it? Scrubbing the players' boots and doing those sorts of
Yeah,
things. We've moved on from that, haven't we now?
times have definitely
Times
changed.
have
Yeah, for
changed,
sure.
but I think what she did recognize was that people had recognized her talent. So she knew she was smart, her words, and that call to go to the, was it the International Meeting of American Heart Association,
Yeah.
was somebody saying, actually, you can do more. And that was
Yeah.
good. That was good to hear, wasn't it? That somebody had spotted that early in her career at a time that probably she was talking at one stage about the late 70s. And, so that's somebody very forward thinking to do that. And everybody now has talked about, I was in the right place at the right time, or serendipity. And even as a vice chancellor, she still said serendipity. I
Yeah.
still tried to fight my corner that you have to be the right person to gain
I
from
know.
serendipity. But I think there's clearly a fabulous story to tell there, isn't there? And this it's one of those interviews where it's full of gems, and you could the person that you interview could actually write a book. There's a career there and a story to be told, isn't there? So that from the PhD, having a nurse mentor again, very, very early time to have a nurse mentor, but having to do it in a medical school, from what it sounded like, an associate professor before she became a professor. And then I felt she started to talk more like a vice chancellor then. I felt I understood that she thought of the business side of it. So I under how I heard it, she got a very strategic sense of what you do with research. Now, I've never heard people talk about the rainmaker and the person to
No.
bring in the money. I think we know it that happens, but I quite liked the fact that she was sort of suggesting that that's if you're going to survive as a research culture, you've got to do that. So she had the
Yeah.
positives of being engaging and giving people opportunity, but also you've got to bring in the money. And as a vice chancellor, I'm sure you know that no, nobody knows that better than you.
Yeah, I suppose it is a very different perspective, isn't it? When you're perhaps a nurse researcher or early career researcher, you're not necessarily thinking about bringing in the money, are you? Thinking about
No.
creating impact through your research. So I suppose it is just that different view of leaders that are within universities and what their focus has to become. But yeah, really interesting about how she spoke about the hierarchical structure that existed and where nurses kind of fit into that at that point. But I also sense this strong desire from her that she did say that she felt a bit constrained, didn't she? Even when she was a student nurse, and maybe it was just that time period. I don't know. Maybe this sense of this hierarchical structure that existed and where nurses fit, and she needed to break free from that. But very interesting and serendipity. Yeah, it's come up again, hasn't it? But those supportive and those enabling environments that she highlighted are really important, aren't they? And finding those people that encourage you, like the cardiologist, that maybe sometimes you think, well, can I do that? Am I allowed to do this? And just being told sometimes to, why don't you do this? Even though you probably have thought about it, but you actually don't realize you can do it. It's like you need permission. Of course, sometimes you do need permission, don't you? But it certainly helps, doesn't it, to have those people that are there to give you that advice and support. So it's finding those right people, I think.
And she could talk like a vice chancellor. She said, be in an environment that will support you beyond tokenism. As the
Yeah.
employee of a university, you're probably not going to say that out loud, but if you're the vice chancellor of a university, you can make a difference there, can't you, and make sure that that's not happening.
Yeah,
So,
yeah.
and I've had two visits, very fortunate to have had two visits to Wollongong University or the University of Wollongong, and really sort of the staff are a credit to her. There's a nice research environment underway, and you can see that there's leaders, and there are new people coming through, and people are developing their own portfolios of research. So it's rubbed off. It's rubbed off. And I think she's recognized she's actually obviously had to focus on the whole of that university, but from what a role model she must B2. Nurses in that university to know that vice chancellor can be a nurse.
Yeah, and it presents a different opportunity that perhaps people don't think about, do they, of becoming a vice chancellor of university? Not something that you really is really spoken about, I don't think, is
No,
it really, as an
no.
opportunity? Perhaps, there's also that, lack of understanding of what vice chancellors do. So it's really good, really helpful, I think, to understand, her story from being a vice chancellor anyway. And being in that position, I suppose, to be able to cultivate that environment is a bit different, isn't it, to being in that environment. So, yeah,
Well,
very
we're not
interesting.
starting a vice chancellor podcast. Just
No.
so you know, I don't think we'd have many people that were as willing to speak as Trish was, and as forthcoming and helpful in wanting to speak to us. I was equally surprised that she was very quick to say that she would change a few things. We've had a lot of people more junior than Trish say, yeah, actually I'm happy with where I am, and everything's gone okay, and I know I wouldn't change a thing. But she was very quick, wasn't she, to probably use the knowledge she has now to suggest you could have done things differently, like she talked about where she'd published in high impact journals. But that's developed over time, hasn't it? Now, as we've in the UK, we push towards ref, and we talk about 4-star papers, and we talk about money. A lot of that's known now that wasn't then. I even when I first started to sort of write up my research or write up for publication for the first time, I just wanted it published, really. I didn't really think about the impact or the peer reviewed journal. I was just happy to have my name in headlights, as it were, on the paper. And I think now we're pushing that with people from the very start, aren't they? That you might be under this pressure yourself to, where you're going to publish the papers from your PhD, and are they going to be in a high impact? And so we know that from a much more junior position now, don't we?
And I think it's also figuring it out. There's a lot to understand, I think, around publication, and where to position your work. You can position it if you can write to the standard of that particular journal, that's great. Or, just because a journal isn't necessarily got a really high impact factor, it might actually reach a really wide audience. So there's quite a few things to consider, isn't there? And also the topic and the scope, of the journal. But I guess it's deciding what your aim is and aiming high.
And w when you start out, I often say to people I try to support and mentor that sometimes you're writing for readership. You want as many people to read as possible. You don't want it behind a paywall, and you're trying to develop your discipline. So it depends what it is that you're publishing. There are sometimes the right place isn't the high impact journal. It depends what it is that you're putting out there. So, I wouldn't ever put people off writing, for the sake of the journal, because sometimes it's hard to get that to that level. But I think once you start being a researcher, and then you're always aiming for the highest journal you can find. But some great advice and real interesting to listen to, and to have somebody so high up in their institution willing to do this with us. I don't think
Yes.
we'll have another vice chancellor on, so a great bonus episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Andrew.
No problem at all. So thank you for your time. We'll wrap it up there.
Thank you very much.
See you next time. Thanks, Helena.
Bye-bye.